Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. And today I'm delighted to be joined by some amazing experts. If we can keep this to the 30 minutes that we planned, then I'll be amazed given the conversations I've had with them offline in the run-up to this. But please welcome Penny Jackson from Aristos Partnership. Hi, Penny.
Hi.
And Rebecca Stevenson from Highlands College, Jersey.
Hello.
Hi. And my erstwhile colleague, Ellie Hurst from Advent IM.
Hello.
Today we're going to be talking about, a range of topics that fit broadly into the title of culture and leadership. So I thought we'll kick off then. The role of leadership in cybersecurity culture. Now, this was something we discussed at a conference that we're all participated in earlier this year, and which got me thinking about the point of this podcast. But how does leadership set the time for cybersecurity awareness, cyber resilient culture, and how do we get the idea of cybersecurity to be more embedded into the wider organizational values? Who'd like to kick us off there then today? How about Penny?
Okay. I think it's essential that leadership lead the process on cyber. And if they don't, you get a gap of somebody at the bottom trying to push up the messaging and the rest of the organisation paying lip service to it. When I was working with the NHS, one of the requirements of the process was that the C-suite, because they were getting free support for 2 years, had to pay attention, and the CEO endorsed everything that we did. So when I was sitting with those organisations, 10 Trusts and PHE at the time, I think it was called, Public Health England, they automatically paid attention to all of the governance suggestions we made, all the recommendations, all the communication and the awareness. And as a consequence, in that moment in time, for that period of time, there was real attention paid by all of the structure in the business. When I moved over to retail in the John Lewis partnership, the whole process was in reverse. I was under a very senior security director, but it was getting the rest of the business to pay attention to it. So there was real intent, but it was an enormous organization. And then you become something like shouting in the dark and trying to get people to pay attention. And if you don't have, as I did, strategic relationship with the leaders in the first place, I think you're on hiding to nothing. I think you're really struggling if you are placed other and not with access to leadership to tell the engagement piece around cyber.
Rebecca, you're in a very different environment there, working in higher education, based over in Jersey, limited resources and a small team, as we've discussed offline. What's your approach there?
Well, it has to be different because, first of all, we're in education. We don't have the resources that large corporations do or large bodies. And we're also on a very small island. I did for a time work at Pinsent Mason's in the UK, which has global offices. And what I realised there is that there is leadership buy-in that is absolutely vital, completely. But there are also opportunities for leadership to happen in different ways around the company. And what I mean by that is that when you've got offices all around the globe, you can't just rely on that one single message from one single office in London when you've got offices in Perth and Sydney and Shanghai and South Africa. So you then need to find a new way to have leadership, and that's to have advocates or champions in your offices that have that tangible relationship with the rest of the office and can act as a security leader. So that's one way to achieve it. But here on a small island, it is really quite difficult in education to translate that view. And this is where it's important that people pick up their messages from the local community as well. You can use the local community and the collective to spread security messages. We are suffering at the moment a little bit of food shortage in Jersey. We've only got about 3 days of food on the island at any one time. And every so often when the weather's bad, we can't get the food in. But we've had these cyber attacks that have happened in the UK with the Co-op and Marks and Spencers. They've affected us in a way that they wouldn't affect You guys on the mainland, Co-op used to have a food storage unit here, and we don't have that anymore. So with all the disruption that's happened with the technology, we've had a weekend with many shops with shelves that are bare, almost taking us back to COVID times. So when you're affected like that, you almost don't need the leadership, because when your food's taken away and you get that kind of tangible sort of experience of what a cyber attack is, you're sort of forced to think a little bit differently about it. So that's kind of where we are at the moment.
I think that's interesting, because I live in a rural location here in the North Pennines, and we've had exactly the same problem. All of the local shops within 12 to 15 miles of where I live are local co-ops, and they've all had massive food shortages in a way that I haven't seen for a long, long time. And I have had conversations with people who work in the co-op about cybersecurity, which I never thought I would see. So certainly I think when you have that real life impact, something that brings it to life, we've had people in my community using the word cyber that I've lived up here for over a decade, never heard the word cyber once. So it is interesting.
I think when you find yourself in a situation that allows you to talk about resilience and cybersecurity in real life situations, it is a little bit jarring, mostly jarring for the people who never have to do that. But it's something that you and I, Mike, have talked about many times when we think about information and data, when it's carried around and used. If it was carried around and used in real life terms, you know, we'd all need a forklift truck to carry around the amount of data with us that we currently use in our sort of like commute to work even. And I think that's a really interesting point. And I feel sometimes we have become a little bit disconnected from the reality of what our modern lives are. And every once in a while, something like this comes along to reacquaint us with our dependence on technology and our need to think consistently about leadership in this area. And you know, it's going to be different in different situations. So yeah, interesting stuff.
Is that maybe a mistake that sometimes is made by cybersecurity leaders, that we don't use enough real life context, we don't make it tangible, we don't make it something that, you know, ordinary people, if I can use that term, can relate to?
I think the cyber stories, the reason why I find it a fascinating subject is there's an ooh, that's interesting moment. There are so many fascinating moments about how did people get in and how did it happen and what was the consequence. And that that is not utilised well. I don't think the industry as storytellers is well placed. I think the conversation around the professionalisation of the communication of this issue is poor. The money's on the tech. It's not on the people that are doing the engagement and awareness. And very often they're not employed with those skill sets in mind. They're brought on with those skill sets as they work in the job. So knowing what works doesn't necessarily mean something they bring to the job. I'm hoping that's improving. But something around how do leadership talk, how do CISOs talk to the leadership? There was a very good talk by a CISO about how do you talk to the board? And he was talking, saying, you've only got 20 minutes, you need to do but also utilize real-time stories, real-life stories in the moment. How is that going to impact my business? And then the board sit up and pay attention. So even CISOs are saying, or even, that sounds a bit patronising, but CISOs are pointing out that if you don't talk to the board in a language of this is a business impact that potentially could affect us this way, they don't want to know, because they don't have time within the many, many things that they're seeing monthly or quarterly to review. Therefore, you need to pay attention. And it's the story of what does this mean to my business? So I think you're right. The real life examples can be wrapped around to staff and to leadership.
Something we've talked about a lot, isn't it, Ellie, about the need for the communication style to be flexed. And I was just thinking there in terms of, you know, it's a term that I've heard bandied around a fair bit over the years, but emotional intelligence.
Yeah, this interests me greatly, because as teachers, we use emotional intelligence all the time. And what struck me as Penny was speaking is that actually a lot of our systems are designed to protect the technology and not the human. But there's always a human right at the other end, a human who needs a job in that company, a human who needs food in Jersey. I mean, we use multiple intelligences when we are teaching. We expect our students to have different preferred learning styles. And having that pedagogy input into how you communicate differently to different cohorts is really important. So if we're looking at how we communicate to the C-suite, you will still have a range of personalities and interests there. Just like I will be teaching my Bachelor of Science Digital Technology students, and they're all there for the same purpose, but they've got a diverse range of ways in which they absorb information and then decide whether it's important to them personally or not. So sometimes looking at that is a really useful tool. I will have, for any teaching that I do, I will have five or six different ways to communicate one theory or one point or one idea. And I will flex in and out of all of those different ways throughout a lesson quite dynamically, depending on what's going on at the time. And I think it'd be really interesting to use that approach in cybersecurity training. And I don't like the word training, because training implies you're learning a very binary skill and you're going to repeat it until you get it right, like training the dog to sit, training the toddler to use a potty. Once you've got it, you're nailed. I don't think in any kind of cyber education we will ever have it nailed, because the landscape's always moving. And I think moving to a more agile, adaptable teaching model rather than training is probably one of the best ways we could do that, because the cyber attackers are using emotional intelligence back on us, and we're using systems that protect the technology only. And I feel strongly about this because I'm on an island that's run out of some food. And it was, there was social engineering involved in the recent attacks on the supermarkets. And we can't go 15 miles to the next shop because our island is 9 miles across, 5 miles up and down. And apart from that, we're stuck in the channel. So unless you're really good at fishing, you know, you're stumped. So I think looking at that whole way in which people absorb information, tapping into what's personal to them, thinking about our colleagues and employees as people with different learning and communication styles, in addition to their role, that can really fortify a strong message and help.
I don't think we ever hear the word pedagogy enough in the cyber world.
Well, I also, that whole piece about I spoke at a learning and development webinar. I wrote an article for the CLL 100 saying, why are the learning and development teams not paying attention? Because they have that skill set. They're not teachers, but they come from that tradition of pedagogy, understanding how people learn, different styles of paying attention to information, and yet they are not roped into cyber training or teaching, as we'd prefer it to be expressed as, because they see that as other. I think I mentioned before that I did a small survey with that group and said, how many of you are involved with cyber? And the answer came back, none, we're too busy. Too busy doing what? This is your top risk. And if it's about sustaining the ability of the organization to continue to learn, to protect itself and be a business, then it can't be something that the learning and development team shouldn't be involved with. So if they're professionals and have professional training like teachers, we should be employing that process and weaving them into the awareness and training people.
Isn't that part of the challenge, though, is that if you look at a lot of cyber risk assessments, they're very technical, they focus on the technology. Rebecca, you've made that point. Usually the human and behavioral elements are if at best overlooked and often completely unaddressed and seen as somebody else's problem, because we're cyber, we look after cyber, and cyber is IT.
It's a mindset thing. I think the Information Security Workforce study a few years ago pointed out the fact that employers were saying, we expect you to be technical. This is a given. given the nature of your role. What we need is for you to be a communicator. We need for you to be able to communicate the risk to us in a way that's speed to insight so we can do something about it. You've passed all your exams and that's great. You've got all your certificates, in other words, that's lovely. What we really need is for you to guide us in a way that we can understand in the same way as we receive information from other departments in the business that tell us about risk that's on those risk registers. So what we need is for you to be able to communicate with us. And I thought that was very telling, that it's saying, you know, we know you're clever. That's brilliant. Carry on being clever and brilliant and wonderful. But now we're telling you, we also need you to have this traditionally viewed as a soft skill so that you can talk to us. And it's the translation piece that seems to be absent in so many, not in all, obviously, you know, some businesses do it rather brilliantly, but in many cases, it's entirely absent.
It's very rare that I have a conversation with anybody in other disciplines where there are quite so many acronyms and TLAs out there.
I was thinking that I'm just working with an organisation and taking them through a resilience review. And one of that is to understand the human risk, which is the first time that a senior team have gone, the human risk is why we want to, is the most important thing, and the CISA team controls and the other thing and the exercise, which is music to my ears. So I think there's beginning to be a shift. Let's hope after Marks and Spencer's and Co-op and Harrods, there's a greater shift and a greater speed at which that happens. There's recognition in the conferences that we attend that the voice around human risk and the awareness piece is wholly underfunded and misunderstood and not professionalised. So maybe that's beginning to shift. But if you look at the energy that's put in by either the tech teams and they just look at the tech controls, or what else they have to do, which is the compliance tick boxing to be insured, CIS-18, NIS, whatever it is they're being required to do. And the same in Europe, and they're more cumbersome, like I forgot what the Spanish one is done, but I've just been looking at that. All of them talk about human awareness and training, but it's like section 14 out of 18 sections, and it's tick. Training, yeah, do awareness. There isn't how are you expressing or evidencing this like you would do with all the other controls. So that whole industry is focused on confirming they're doing what they say they're doing, apart from we all understand. So it's a very direction, yeah.
And it's interesting, you've used the word resilience in that bit there. And of course, the UK has just announced that it is introducing the Cyber Security and Resilience Bill. So I'd like to sort of just explore for a moment the difference between security on one hand and resilience on the other hand.
So I think that's come a lot from the NCSC's ambition that they want to create citizen resilience within the UK. So when they brought in the IoT regulation last year, which was anything that is internet enabled, like your baby alarm or your doorbell, it has to no longer have admin as the default password. And so very simple changes. But the ambition that the NCSC said, and I was working with them because I was at the John Lewis Partnership and we were partnering with them, was about citizen resilience. So I'm really pleased that that's come into the terminology. I think if you look at when I'm looking at this organisation and other organisations, if you have, as Rebecca suggested, not just a senior level of understanding of cyber risk, but you enable, maybe you have ambassadors or champions, whatever you want to call them, but you enable and give them time to express cyber amongst the organisation and the staff, you're building resilience because they're understanding why it's an issue. It's not just something I have to do once a year as my mandatory training. And then if something does happen and you build in resilience in terms of what's the most important operational thing I need to bring back tomorrow? Well, the delivery of food with the co-op is they decided to pull the plug. So they had no idea in their just-in-time delivery capability of the food, which is done just-in-time in order and just-in-time delivery. But they are saying that that's coming back faster because someone was brave enough to switch it off and not like Marks and Spencer's, and they're still hunting for the bad bits. So people who are then going to make decisions about this other than IT operationally will have a better understanding of what they would need to do in the event of a cyber attack, which, let's face it, is so likely now that you need to be prepared for not just your BCP plan with 2,000 sub-bullets. You need about 10 things. What do I need to do in the moment in time?
It's a whole organisation approach, isn't it, Rebecca, that we need to be taking here? And cyber cannot be sat in an organisation operating in isolation.
I'd go beyond that. I'd say it's a societal approach that we need. And if we're going to move away from everything being just technical, which we need to, we've got so many of our principles built on that OSI layers that start off with the physical and end with the sort of like the, you've got the presentation layer and the application layer all at the top, that lovely seven layer model, which is probably the first thing we all start to study when we're going into cyber or computer science. And what I don't like is that layer seven always refers to us as an end user. But actually, that's the point at which we start using the technology and the humanity comes into it. We're kind of there at level five, level six, we can see the screen, level seven, we're sort of human doings on the computer. And we do talk about level eight. I'd say there's more layers than that. I'd say there's level eight, nine, and 10, where we are interacting, where we need the governance, but it's not quite there because it's a tick box. And then you've got the imprint left behind. You've got a whole human journey that continues on from that, that where we have missed that out of the equation when we've been designing the safeguarding measures. And I use the term safeguarding because I think we need to get away from security, because that's as if we need to lock a door. We need to safeguard society, especially if we're going to run out of food. and we're not end users. We are part of that whole chain of data getting from there to there, and it's about the technology to support us. And when it fails because it gets broken deliberately or by accident, that is a human safeguarding issue rather than I would say a security issue, because the impact that we're feeling now is letting us know that things, you know, they tumble back onto the human and they take things away that you hadn't thought of. You know, I'm not bothered about the data, but can I get my jacket potatoes tonight? I don't think so. You know, there are some real physical impacts now. Do you know what I mean? And we've been missing those out as if it's technology and it doesn't physically hurt or affect us. And it does, actually. And the emotional fallout as well, if somebody feels they've been scammed or they feel that, I've come across really badly some sextortion attempts from some colleagues where they've been sent like threatening letters with, you know, you've got to put money in this wallet and all the rest of it. And it's not about that. It's the emotional repercussions as well. So this is a safeguarding issue, I would say.
I would agree with that totally. So, I mean, this goes way beyond what we can fix in terms of cyber legislation or regulation. And potentially even standards, doesn't it? Then, and I'm just thinking in terms of timeline, you know, we've had, you know, local authorities, and that's impacted on civic supply of services. We've had the health service and what happened in London with people's operations and vital blood tests being delayed and putting people's health on the line. And now we've had our own food supply and people not being able to get access to food in rural and diverse communities. So, you know, this is something that has, over the years, has rapidly impacted huge swathes of society, not just large corporates, or as the hackers would want us to believe, that this is an attack on commercialization, that this is an attack on society itself.
Now, I was going to say, I've been recently looking into how finance rather than technology deal with this issue. And I discovered that finance work closer towards a 10-layer model than a 7, for example. But running through every single stream, they have this theme of know your customer. And I really like that because it's not separating the person from the money, and it is showing that the behaviour or the profile or the, you know, the situation of the customer rather than somebody who's going to get into trouble for, you know, sort of not using their IT properly and clicking on the wrong link. So know your customer, the person you are serving. I think we've got a lot to learn actually from that. And obviously the finance industry isn't sort of like completely removed from being attacked. But I think just that little approach where we just kind of shift how we're looking at who we're trying to serve really. Who is the customer? Who do we want to help? Who is the person with the value? What thing has the value rather than the technology itself? I think we've got other industries we could still learn a lot from.
So I love the fact that you use the phrase safeguarding, because I think it fits in with the concept of resilience. If we are considering that cyber attacks affect multiple individuals in multiple ways, whether it's not being able to shop or it affects their hospital treatment. In fact, there was the first incident, I think it was in 2020, I may be wrong with the dates, where an incident of death was directly related to a cyber attack. They were able to track back that the blocking of somebody able to be traveling in an ambulance was actually the reason for that person's death. And it was the fact that that whole process had been hit by a cyber attack. So if we were able to, if the stories that were told were, like you said, Mike, is that it's not just about this is happening to organizations that are profiteering around the world globally, but this is actually impacting life. And this is, and therefore, the safeguarding expression rather than security is that all human life is important. And what you're doing isn't some kind of fun taking the profits. It's actually destroying people's safety. And I think that's a much better way of expressing it, particularly now, when it's so prevalent. It is just, there isn't an opportunity to say it's not really going to happen to me. It's a matter of when it is, and it's even more likely than it ever was before.
So do we feel that the current education system, and here I'm not talking about education within our workforce, within our organisation, but the education system more generally, is fit for purpose in equipping us with the professionals of the future who are going to be able to address that challenge?
I think so. Speaking from the course we run here jointly with Plymouth University, I think we do, because all students get to choose to do cybersecurity as part of their training. And that is done in a year where they are also doing their work placements 4 days a week. So they are actively learning and going into their workplaces at the same time, do you see? So they're having to sort of put into practice and learn and feel it in context. And actually, one of our students this year, as for his final project, has come up with the concept of using Web3 wallets in order to help with password security and safety, and sort of invented that as a concept as part of his degree to try and sort of like show how he understands and what he could contribute to the future of cybersecurity as well. So it is on the minds of students, and they are interested. Now, whether that filters through to the rest of the institution I'm in at the moment, we do online safeguard training, but that's very much dealt with from the personal perspective of their well-being rather than the well-being they can contribute to the future companies they work for. And actually, I think given the age range we teach and the development they're at, I think that's right. And I think if we can start people thinking about their own personal safety online at a much younger age, at some point that's going to filter through, because they'll start developing that instinct that we don't really have. it will filter through to when they're in the workplace, because they've had that from a much younger age and from the personal perspective rather than the you need to keep the company's data safe perspective, I think.
I think what worries me about the way education, or certainly ministers and people in decision-making positions, talk about young people and safeguarding them by preventing them from accessing the internet. don't allow them to do this, don't allow them to do that. Far better would be to educate teachers and young people of how they can prevent themselves from falling into the traps of social engineering. What are they looking at when they are having somebody look at their streams and then it is all accumulated into something that they always think is happening? You know, this whole process of not discussing the truth of the thing that they're looking at, I'm not even sure, certainly my children are beyond that point. They're already out in the world. So I can't say whether that's still happening. But when they were learning about computing, the IT teachers, I have to say, were teaching them at such a low level of access that they really didn't get what they were needing to understand. The children were ahead of the game already. So what we need is a better understanding of societal risk, not from a don't, but from a, this is what you're experiencing. If you see something, your algorithms are pushing you to see more of what you think is right, and therefore you're not getting a balanced viewpoint. Utilize the way they teach history, which is check your sources, question that you are actually being told what you think you're being told. That would be the move forward, because I'm not convinced that that's on the agenda, and I certainly don't see that coming up as, to my knowledge, on curriculum. I'd be happy to be proved wrong about that.
It is in all schools that I know of, through the PSHE curriculum, online safety is delivered. Here at Highlands, we've got, it's an integrated part of our future skills, pastoral care. So in terms of the safeguarding of children from online harms, that's where we are, certainly here in Jersey. We have just actually had a huge debate in the chambers about whether we should actually ban mobile phones in schools. And it was a very challenging, hotly fought debate, with lots of views and examples and statistics and thought put into it. And the outcome was that we wouldn't ban children from having phones or taking them into school. That doesn't mean the debate is closed shut forever, but it is something that is very much in the minds and the consciousness of everybody at every level. But I don't think that we are going to solve that as a problem until we start looking at things a little bit differently and having maybe more of that finance model where we don't have the same restrictions on children's mobile phones as we do on children's bank accounts. Right, we just don't think that it's needed. We value that the actual device more than what's in it. When you've got a bank account, you've got a bank account, and if you close the bank account, your bank account number doesn't go to somebody else, but your phone number does. And you need an adult to be responsible at every step of a bank account of a child. And that happens at the point that the bank account's opened, right? That we do not have that approach with technology. We still could integrate that. I'm actually talking about it tomorrow at our research festival. We've never had that approach where we have taken something that finance do so easily and seamlessly, and it's taken for granted because it's to do with money. But if it's children's data, for some reason, we go, oh, that's too difficult, or the parents can manage it. No, the school can manage it. No, society can manage it. It's at the single point that a bank account is opened and the parent and the bank have responsibility until that child's a certain level. We have never entertained doing that with our children's digital data. So we are using our education programs to try and educate them. But that's like saying they've got free rein on money and we're just going to tell them a little bit about how to spend it.
Feels to me like child safeguarding could be a whole new topic in its own right. Maybe we can tempt you back as one of our guests for future podcasts to delve deeper into that. Because I think a lot of what you're saying there, I totally agree with. How do we ensure then that we're equipping the future generation of cybersecurity leaders with the right breadth of skills? You know, we know that people are coming into our profession with technical skills, but you know, how are we going to ensure that they've got this emotional intelligence, that they understand human behavior, that they've got a grasp on psychology, And that rounded approach to humanistic security and safeguarding can be part of the strategy of the future.
I'm not sure we want all our leaders to have all of that skill set, because I think that's impossible with the diversity that we require in an organisational structure. What we do need, though, is an emphasis that need to pay attention to those things. So it's not good enough to say, well, I'm the finance director and I only focus on finance, to use your example, Rebecca. You have to also pay attention to the risks that could impact your finance, lovely area of the business. And if that, and I don't know a business that isn't now registering cyber as one of their top risks, personally, I would make it their top one. Therefore, you must pay attention to that. But not only that, to bring in the people element of it, I would, as a CISO, be reporting still what is the level of attacks that are happening that are socially engineered, that are basically the manipulation of staff and individuals, because that's not spoken about in a way that the risk can be fully understood by the C-suite. It's numbers, it's data, it's blah, this business did that. But the beauty of, sadly, of the Marks and Spencer's example is it was a social engineering of an IT team that thought they were either above being socially engineered because they thought they knew about security because they're IT, or that the teams, that the people that they pretended they were when they asked for the password changes, were senior enough that they didn't feel able to challenge. So the people element has to be something they need to pay attention to. If we're going to tell stories to the C-suite and to the rest of the staff, that's one we need to pay attention to. What is the impact of the psychological and the social engineering of individuals that is impacting potentially your business? Take the word cyber out. What's the effect of people clicking on this or being told they can change something? And then maybe they'll pay attention.
Yeah, so I think we need to consider having a collective approach as well. In terms of the leadership being involved, Penny's absolutely right. Not everybody needs to know absolutely everything, but we, as a collective, we all want to have the same result, which is for things to be safer, for people to be aware, and to have that resilience, because we need to accept that things will happen. There will be cyber attacks, and to know what we're going to do when that happens. That's the important thing.
And Ellie, just to wrap up then, you've spent a career as a communicator who has transitioned into the cyber world. So any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I would say that in its broadest possible sense, communication is the key to everything. I know I would say that, but in our service businesses and organisations, we're a little reticent about communicating about things that have happened to us. We're getting better. I think societally we are getting better. But the bad actors communicate very well. They share tools, they share ideas, they share lists, they share everything. And I think we need to adopt a little bit more of that kind of attitude, which means that we are communicating with each other in real time about real things that are happening and sharing that experience in order to be able to get a little bit more on the front foot and, you know, generally allow our security experts to be the experts that they need to be and allow them to be horizon scanning, because we are aware of the things that are happening. We're talking about them. We know how they're unfolding. I do think societally we are getting better, but I think communication overall is a bit of a weak spot, a bit of an Achilles heel when it comes to security and resilience.
This is without doubt a conversation that I could happily have all afternoon with you guys. Thank you so much for your time here today. No doubt something that we'll keep coming back to, as we have many times over the years. And hopefully at future conferences, we'll find culture, behaviour, humanism and all psychology and all of those great things actually an embedded part of the CISO conference rather than the side room. We can but hope, eh? This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. A big thank you to my guests here today, to Penny. Thank you, Penny. To Rebecca, thank you very much. And I hope you get your food shortage in Jersey sorted out soon. I'm certainly praying that this weekend we'll see some stock shelves up here in the North Pennines. And to Ellie, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
This is the Advent IM podcast, Risk in Business. As always, if you've liked it, make sure you give us a thumbs up. Don't forget to share it with your friends and colleagues. And if there are future conversations you'd like us to be having, then get in touch and let us know. But for now, I've been Mike Gillespie. Thank you very much.